Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 20th Annual Marco De Porras Social Justice Lecture, sponsored by the Justice and Peace Studies Program in Creighton's College of Arts and Sciences, in honor of Father John Marco, S.J., who started the Omaha De Porras Club in 1947. Their patron, Martin De Porras from Peru, was canonized by the Catholic Church in 1962. The speaker will be David Hollenbach, University Chairman in Human Rights and International Justice at Boston College. He'll speak on the topic Pacem in Terris et 50, Catholics and Human Rights in the 21st Century. Father Hollenbach is making a return appearance in this lecture series, having given the first Marco De Porras Social Justice Lecture at Creighton in 1994. The title of his lecture is most appropriate for Christmas week. Pacem in Terris is the name of an encyclical on justice and peace issued by Pope John XXIII on April 11, 1963, the title referring to the message of the angels in the Gospel of Luke, announcing the birth of Jesus, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men of good will. Pacem in Terris is the Latin phrase for peace on earth. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, November 14, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Roger Bergman, Director of the Justice and Peace Studies Program and Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Social Work at Creighton University.
30 years ago, when I decided to pursue a master's degree in theology, there was only one school to which I applied. Although I had never met a Jesuit, I knew of the Jesuits' reputation for academic excellence. I had also come to believe that Father David Hollenbach was the outstanding Catholic social ethicist in the United States. So I attended Weston Jesuit School of Theology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The three courses I took with him still deeply inform my sense of what it means to be a socially and intelligently engaged Catholic Christian. When we started the Justice and Peace Studies program here at Creighton in the mid-90s, we also initiated the Marco De Porras Social Justice Lecture Series. There was no doubt who the inaugural lecturer should be. And there was no doubt who should commemorate the 20th anniversary of that founding lecture. Father David Hollenbach of the Society of Jesus holds the University Chair in Human Rights and International Justice at Boston College. He has also taught at Georgetown University, at Hekima College of the Catholic University in Nairobi, at the Jesuit Philosophy Institute in Ho Chi Minh City, and for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Southern Africa. Father Hollenbach is past president of the Society of Christian Ethics. He has received the John Courtney Murray Award for Outstanding Contributions to Theology from the Catholic Theological Society of America, and the Marianist Award, given by the University of Dayton to a Roman Catholic whose work has made a major contribution to the intellectual life. Father Hollenbach is the author or editor of too many influential books and articles to name here. Let me just say that you can draw a straight line from the book that convinced me to go to Weston, Claims in Conflict, Retrieving and Renewing the Catholic Human Rights Tradition, published in 1979, to Economic Justice for All, the pastoral letter of the U.S. Catholic Bishops of 1986, for which Father Hollenbach served as principal ethics consultant. His most recent books include Driven from Home, Protecting the Rights of Forced Migrants, and Refugee Rights, Ethics, Advocacy, and Africa. Please welcome Father David Hollenbach.
Thank you so much, Roger. It's a real privilege to be back here at Creighton, commemorating the time that I was here some years ago for the first of these Marco De Porras lectures, but also last summer I had the opportunity to be here as well for a conference that took place largely the main sessions in this room on justice in Jesuit higher education. So it's a pleasure and a privilege to be back with you here at Creighton. So thank you very much for inviting me to return. I'm going to speak about the 50th anniversary of the papal encyclical Pacem in Terris, Peace on Earth, issued by Pope John the 23rd in 1963, 50 years ago. This document, Pacem in Terris, has been called the Magna Carta of Catholic engagement in human rights issues. Since the encyclical was issued 50 years ago, the Catholic community has become deeply engaged in the promotion and support for human rights throughout the world. The recent social teachings of popes and bishops, as well as the engagement undertaken by individual Catholics, by Catholic associations, have increasingly been formulated in terms of human rights. Catholic thought and advocacy grounds its appeal to human rights in an affirmation of that human dignity is the most basic standard to which all personal behavior and social institutions should be held accountable. Pope John the 23rd affirmed in this document that the modern Catholic social tradition is controlled, he said, by one basic theme, an unshakable affirmation and defense of the dignity and rights of the human person. This commitment has led the Catholic community to become a significant force for the promotion of human dignity and human rights in Latin America, in the former Warsaw Pact countries such as Poland and Czechoslovakia, in Asian nations like the Philippines and South Korea, and increasingly in African countries. Because of these developments, the late Samuel Huntington, professor of international politics at Harvard until his death a few years ago, concluded that post-Vatican II Catholic Church had become one of the strongest worldwide forces for human dignity, human rights, and democracy throughout the world. Indeed, Huntington said that if you look at the developments of human rights and democracy in the 1970s and 80s, that the Catholic community was the single largest force behind that movement. In this presentation this evening, I want to note, first of all, some of the developments in human rights thought and practice that have taken place within secular thought and practice in recent decades. Secondly, I want to sketch the important shift in the Catholic approach to human rights that Peace on Earth, the encyclical we're commemorating tonight, helped to bring about. Third, I want to discuss how Catholicism links human rights with the pursuit of the common good and with human solidarity, and how this leads to a special concern for the rights of the poor and the marginalized in society. And finally, I'm going to raise a few suggestions about the possibility that the development of Catholic thought on human rights has not come to an end, and that we could well see significant developments in the Catholic stance on human rights in relation to gender roles, including the rights of gay persons, in the years ahead. So, first, some secular developments. When the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights was proclaimed in 1948, many saw it as a promise never again to tolerate genocide or the colonial domination of one people by another. Marianne Glendon, a legal scholar who has traced the history of the drafting of the Universal Declaration, called it a charter for a world made new. In the wake of the horrors of World War II, the mightiest nations of the earth, Glendon says, bowed to the demands of smaller countries for recognition of a common standard by which the rights and wrongs of every nation could be measured. The absence of such common standards was seen by the drafters of the Universal Declaration as one of the key sources of war itself. From 1948 to 1989, however, Cold War ideological strife pushed human rights off of the political agenda. But hopes rose again in the immediate post-Cold War period. For example, in the 1993 United Nations Conference on Human Rights in Vienna, delegates who represented about 85% of the world's population reaffirmed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and declared that the universal binding power of the rights and freedoms it proclaimed were, quote, beyond question. In today's post-9/11 world, however, some see a rising clash of civilizations setting Western nations with their democratic values on a collision course with the system of Islamic Sharia or with a conflict with nations guided by so-called Asian values. And some postmodernist scholars reject human rights norms themselves as incorrigibly Western in the name of a respect for diverse cultures. But others still, such as former President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama, see human rights as truly universal standards, closely linked with democracy. Movements for democracy evident in the creation of the new South Africa, in Burma's Saffron Revolution, and with the recent return to active political life of the Burmese leader Aung San Suu Kyi, and at least in some aspects of what has come to be called the Arab Spring, we see ways in which human rights are deeply valued by at least significant segments of the cultural forces operative in our world today outside of the North Atlantic region. So despite some setbacks, there is little doubt, I think, that human rights since the end of the Cold War have reemerged as important dimensions of international politics and international affairs. So, to my second point about developments in Catholic social thought on this issue. In the face of the ebb and flow of the secular opinion I've just outlined, it is striking how since the issuing of the encyclical Peace on Earth in 1962-63 and the conclusion of the Second Vatican Council in 1965, the Catholic Church and its leadership have been strongly affirming human rights as the moral standards to which all nations and cultures should be held accountable. Now, this is indeed a really remarkable development. For in the 19th century and the early 20th century, Catholicism was a significant source of opposition, both to human rights and to democracy. For example, in 1832, Pope Gregory XVI argued against the fundamental right to freedom of conscience, declaring it to be a form of insanity. The word he used in Latin was delirimentum, craziness. He thought this right to religious freedom implied that religious truth made no sense at all and that any religion was as good as another, something to which the Pope is very unlikely to agree. But less than a century later, Pacementeris affirmed, despite this claim that the right to freedom of conscience is craziness, a century later, Pacementeris affirmed that because every human being is endowed with intelligence and free will, he or she has, quote, rights and duties which together flow as a direct consequence of his or her nature. These rights and duties, Pacementeris said, are universal and inviolable, and therefore altogether inalienable. Quite different from saying that they are insanity. These rights and duties are universal. The Second Vatican Council went further theologically by proclaiming that the Church holds and supports human rights, quote, by virtue of the gospel committed to her. So not only based on reason and intelligence, but based on faith and the gospel itself. Thus, there was a dramatic shift in Catholic thought about human rights, linking the full range of human rights with both human nature itself and with the very core of Christian faith. Now, the reasons for these dramatic changes in both the secular discussions and in church teaching, I think, can give us some important insight into the reasons for supporting and being behind the reality of human rights today. Both of these changes, these developments, were caused, I think, by the experience in part of the wars of the 20th century, wars that led both secular society and the Catholic community to a new awareness that peace is deeply dependent on respect for human dignity and human rights. The fact that an encyclical called Peace on Earth begins with a proclamation of the full range of human rights clearly reflects this awareness of the connection between peace and respect for human rights. Disastrous conflicts like World War I and World War II followed almost inevitably when peoples were divided into an us versus them basis on the basis of nationality, religion, and ethnicity. These conflicts of World War I and World War II soaked the soil of 20th century Europe in blood. Similarly, in-group, out-group division was the root of colonial domination of many parts of the world by European colonial powers, and that this colonial domination often led colonized people to see armed revolt as the only way to throw off their oppression. So again, human rights and peace are linked. Today's bloody ethnic conflicts in too many parts of the world are rooted in a similar denial of the common humanity that the universal rights argument holds up for us. The contemporary human rights ethic, therefore, seeks to tear down the walls, dividing people into those who count and those who do not count. The inherent dignity of all members of the human family must become the organizing basis of the social and political life of global society, the human rights ethos is telling us. The Declaration of Human Rights is universal because it claims to apply to all, every human being. No white rule over non-white. No Aryan over Jew. No European colonist over non-European colonized. No male superiority to female. In addition, religious convictions must never be used to deny the dignity of others in the name of God. Ethnic or national identities are never legitimate grounds for excluding people from the basic requirements of their human dignity. Human rights also call for solidarity across economic divisions, challenging the grave inequalities that mar our globalizing world. The experience of the negative consequences of dividing the human community into us and them was the driving force behind the creation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it remains central to the human rights ethos today. Recognition that the emerging human rights ethic was an expression of our common humanity led Pope John XXIII to an unambiguous stand in support of human rights based on the dignity of the person. Vatican Council II, which was taking place right at the same time that the Pope issued this document, provided both theological and secular warrants for human dignity as the basis of human rights. Theologically or religiously, the book of Genesis teaches that human beings are created in the image and likeness of God. I like to interpret that this way. When we look upon the face of a human being, we are looking into the presence of the sacred. Thus, mistreating a human person is a kind of sacrilege. Further, Christian revelation affirms that because human beings are redeemed and recreated by Christ, believers are called to esteem human dignity even more highly than our rational nature would imply. Thus, the church's mission to defend human dignity and rights flows from the heart of the Christian faith itself. At the same time, the Second Vatican Council offered what can be called secular warrants for its affirmation of the dignity of the person. These warrants include the transcendence of our mind. We are not simply things. We're thinking beings, mind with minds that transcend pure materiality. From the sacredness of our conscience that demands to be respected, from the excellence of our liberty, our freedom, these realities of human thought, of human conscience, of human freedom provide secular experiential support for the dignity of every person that is very much in line with Catholicism's longstanding natural law-based conviction that fundamental ethical responsibilities can be grasped by human reason reflecting on human experience and by philosophical reflection on what it is to be human. This opens the way for Catholic collaboration with those who are not Christians in the struggle for human rights. So it's not only from a religious point of view, but also from a secular point of view, and therefore Christians are engaged in the promotion of human rights as Christians, but can work with those who affirm human rights on other grounds. The developments thus launched by Pacem in Terris have had dramatic effects for the ministry of the church in social life. As I noted before in quoting Sam Huntington, in recent decades, the church has become an activist supporter of human rights around the world. Now, it's true, of course, I need to mention this to show you that I don't overlook the failures that have occurred. The church's engagement in the struggle for human rights has not been uniform and consistent at all times and in all countries. In Argentina, for example, during the so-called Dirty War of the late 1970s and early 80s, some church leaders remained too closely linked with the repressive regime in Argentina. Pope Francis has recently acknowledged that he made some mistakes in his governance of the Jesuit order's response to the emerging situation in Argentina when he was provincial superior of the Jesuits, though it is also clear that Pope Francis, as before he was Pope, protected a sizable number of persons whose lives were threatened by the military regime in Argentina. The latest book publicized about this speaks about Bergoglio's list, something like Schindler's List, a group of people who were protected by Bergoglio, now Pope Francis, during that struggle. Also, I would note that there were some serious mistakes made in Africa. In the horrific Rwanda genocide of 1994, the most Catholic country in all of Africa descended into the ultimate human rights violation, namely genocide. Some Rwandan clerics actually supported the genocide, and indeed some bishops failed to resist it. So there is no doubt that Catholic support for human rights has been uneven. Nevertheless, Peace on Earth, along with the Second Vatican Council, began a movement that has made the promotion of human rights a central aspect of the Church's mission, and this is a truly remarkable development, given the church's resistance to this movement a century earlier. So then to my third point about solidarity and human rights and its implications for the church's response and our response to the poor. The development of the church's support for human rights was in part the result of its recognition that human rights need not be linked with an individualistic philosophy that threatens the common good. The common good is a value with deep roots in the Catholic tradition, and some of the resistance to the human rights ethos from the church came from thinking that rights were about me protecting my stuff from you against the common good of the community. But this objection became clear was not the whole story on the meaning of human rights at all. Objection to the way some thinkers like John Locke linked rights to an individualistic understanding of the person was the basis of some earlier Catholic objections to human rights. But both Pacem in Terris and the Second Vatican Council stressed that human dignity can be achieved only through participation in community. To be achieving my dignity means to be an active member of the human community, because no person is an island. John Donne called no man is an island, but we can say no person, man or woman, is an island. No one can make it on their own. And we can only do that in community. So whatever human rights mean, they have to do with being part of the community, not being insulated against it. Seeing human rights can be understood in ways compatible with the social nature of personhood opened up the way for the Catholic affirmation of human rights and for the Church to defend a concept of human rights grounded in human solidarity. The fact that the dignity of the person can only be realized in community means that human rights protect not only the rights of people to act on their own, not only the right to be left alone, if you will, but also the right to be full participating members of the human community. I'd like to point out, for example, that if you take this notion of the rights of the person as guaranteeing participation in community, it gives a somewhat different spin to a right such as the right to religious freedom that we value so highly in this country. Here, sometimes, the right to religious freedom is understood in an individualistic way, a way that would say, I have the right to believe what I want inside my own private world, and that that religion is a purely private matter inside a narrowly defined circle of privacy, and that religion has nothing to do with life in society and life in public life. But the Catholic view of religious freedom is quite different from that. The Council says it comes within the meaning of religious freedom, that religious bodies should not be prohibited from freely undertaking to show the value of their doctrine for what concerns the organization of society and the whole of human activity. Religious freedom, in other words, is not just about protecting a private zone, but about guaranteeing people the right to try to have an influence on the larger life of society around them. Active engagement of religious believers in public life, not the privatization of religion, is part of the substantive meaning of religious freedom understood this way. Now, this engagement in public life, of course, must be conducted with deep respect for those who hold differing beliefs. And thus the Council, Vatican II, said, believers should at all times refrain from any manner of action which might seem to carry a hint of coercion. So engagement in public, but in a non-coercive, persuasive way that interacts with society in through persuasion. Persuasion through reasonable discourse is the proper mode of public participation for religious believers, especially if they are seeking to influence law or public policy. So this links the understanding of the right to religious freedom with this notion of social participation. More broadly, this solidaristic understanding of the person implies that human rights in their full range include the social and economic rights that guarantee such goods as nutrition and health care. During the Cold War, we in the West were largely inclined to give priority to the so-called civil and political rights, to freedoms of religion, speech, and other rights that are mainly exercised through being able to sort of express oneself in public in a free way. The East, though, the Soviet bloc, was more inclined to see human rights as the social and economic rights that guarantee goods like food and work and housing that come from being able to participate in the goods that are shared by society at large. Getting a job is a form of participation. Having access to health care is a way of participating in the medical resources that are available in the larger human community, and so forth. Persons can live in dignity only when they live in community, and therefore community and sharing in the common good of society is an essential component of what human rights are all about. The give and take of debate in a free society is the intellectual manifestation of the link between personal initiative and social solidarity. But this linkage of persons with community also has material resources that are achieved only if I'm able to get a job, which is to participate in the economy, or find ways of getting access to health care, which is to participate in sharing in the resources of a very complex medical system in an advanced society like our own. Thus, Peace on Earth, Pachem and Terry, supported the full range of human rights contained in the Universal Declaration, both the civil rights, such as the right to free speech or freedom of religion or democratic self-governance, and the social and economic rights to things like food, health care, work, and so forth. Both types of rights must be guaranteed if a person is to be treated with dignity as a participating member of the human community. This leads to the distinctive Catholic stress on the link between human rights and social solidarity, a linkage that is particularly important when we seek to address the economic inequalities of our country and our world today. For example, Pachem and Terry's affirmation of the social and economic rights to food, healthcare, education, and work has important implications for how we think about our duties toward the poor in our country and to those in the poor countries of our world today, such as those in much of sub-Saharan Africa. In much of Africa today, poverty wounds the dignity of the poor persons themselves, and also undermines the well-being of the poor communities in which they live. 50%, plus or minus a few, of all sub-Saharan Africans today are living on less than $1.25 a day. That's about half the cost of a Starbucks cup of coffee as a total income for the day. People with so few economic resources that just getting food is their primary task are not only having their dignity reduced by that very denial of their needs being met, but it also threatens their political life. People who are that poor are often easily persuaded to become willing to barter their votes or their political support for a little bit of economic gain that those with greater resources in their society might be able to provide them. The French political economist Jean-François Bayard has called this the politics of the belly, la politique du ventre, the politics of the guts or the belly. And he points out that in this situation of such desperate poverty, those who are not willing to go along with the powers that be in the political life of society often face withdrawal of support by the patrons in that society, and also sometimes coercion by those who have the guns. Once a pattern of repression has been established in this way, those who presently have the guns stand to lose everything if they lose power, and so they're often ready to fight to keep the power they already have. Thus, this kind of politics, the politics of the belly, becomes a zero-sum game. It easily falls into violent conflict, as it has in eastern Congo, in the Rift Valley of Kenya, in Sudan, and in a number of other parts of Africa. What this is pointing to is the way in which political rights and economic rights are deeply linked with each other. And such conflicts as those in eastern Congo or Sudan create large numbers of refugees and internally displaced people, as well as exacerbating the conditions that cause poverty. Thus, conflict, displacement, and poverty reinforce each other in an increasingly vicious circle. Failure to protect social and economic rights, therefore, and the denial of civil and political rights that we associate with democracy go hand in hand. It's a vicious circle where the economic deprivation and the political repression get deeply interconnected with each other. So how is such a grave situation to be addressed? One response would appeal to the global market as a potential solution. Now, it's true that the expansion of global markets has brought some decline in the percentage of the human race living in poverty in the world as a whole. This is especially true in East Asia, where the growth of the market in China has in fact brought a decline in poverty in that part of the world. And we should be grateful for this progress. But global markets and the freedom of the market has not had uniformly positive impact. More than half the people of the continent of Africa continue to be extremely poor. And people who are illiterate or sick from infection by HIV, for example, people in that condition, illiteracy and grave sickness, can be left altogether out of the benefits of the global market. Even if the market expands, people who have no literacy and who are ill can't share in it and participate in it. They lack, therefore, the benefits that come from the expansion of global markets. As Pope John Paul II put it, therefore, people in that condition of extreme poverty, illness, illiteracy, and so forth, he said, economic development, even if it's taking place, takes place over their heads. That's the phrase of John Paul II, meaning they have no access to the domain where development is taking place. The Church has learned that to counter this phenomenon, we need to seek to advance economic conditions and political accountability of governments simultaneously. Reducing poverty and improving governance must go hand in hand. The Church has come, therefore, to recognize that there is a close linkage between social and economic rights and civil and political rights. Another way of putting this is bread and freedom go together. They're not alternative policies. It's not bread first and then freedom, or freedom first and then bread, but the two need to go together. They must be pursued together because the attainment of one is very often a precondition for the attainment of the other. Today, the Catholic community is perhaps the strongest voice on the world stage today, arguing for this simultaneous pursuit of both social, economic, and civil political rights. And this, too, I think, is a significant development in the Church's contribution to the debate about human rights and to action for human rights 50 years after Pachamentares. Now, to conclude, all these considerations show that the Catholic understanding of human dignity exists within what can be called a living tradition, a tradition open to development, growth, and change. In earlier stages of this tradition, social practices such as restrictions on religious liberty and even slavery were tolerated by the Church. Today, however, Catholic thought judges these practices to be gravely immoral violations of human dignity and human rights. These developments in Catholic thought have occurred as a result of a living interaction between the normative sources of Catholic identity, including the Bible and key doctrinal beliefs, and the ongoing social experience of the Catholic community reflected upon by practical reason. For example, the Church's lived experience of the denial of religious freedom by Hitler and the Soviet state under Stalin led Popes Pius XII and John XXIII to re-examine the Church's earlier conclusion that support for religious freedom was part of a secularizing agenda that threatened the Church's role in public life. This reflection on the experience of denial of religious freedom led to the recognition that the freedom to express one's religious convictions in public is an essential condition for the protection and realization of human dignity. Thus, through a sort of back and forth movement between normative Catholic beliefs on the one side and lived experience on the other, notable developments have occurred in both the more theoretical Catholic understanding of human dignity and in more practical Catholic commitment to the protection of human rights. This way of understanding Catholicism's entry into the contemporary consensus on human dignity and human rights provides a way of understanding past developments of the tradition. But it also suggests, I want to conclude by saying, that we can expect further developments in Catholic understanding of human dignity and rights in the future. In particular, very recent Church teachings on the equality of men and women are often accompanied by an affirmation of a complementarity of male and female gender roles that sometimes, too often in my judgment, leads to a rejection of some of the rights claimed by women. And indeed, this definition of gender roles that is based on complementarity of male and female is also the ground on which the rejection of some of the rights claimed by gay people in same-sex relations are rejected. Clearly, support for same-sex relationships would require a notable departure from aspects of the Catholic moral tradition. And whether such a development is called for, I don't intend to try to settle here tonight. But in the past, Catholic moral understandings have clearly developed and changed in a number of other domains when practical reason indicated that change would serve the human good and promote human dignity. At present, there are notable disputes concerning the appropriate direction for Catholic thought in the domain of sexuality, gender roles, and reproduction, and how these should be lived out in ways that protect human dignity. The past experience of development within the tradition suggests that change should not be ruled out in the way that Catholic thought addresses the relationship between human dignity, gender roles, sex, and reproduction. Rather, we need careful reflection on the human experience of how human dignity is affected by new practices in this area, and then an exploration of how those experiences might interact with normative dimensions of the tradition. The emerging social, political, and technological developments of the requirements of human dignity in the 21st century, of course, should not be expected to call for change only within Catholic thought and practice. Other traditions, both religious and secular, may need to change as well. In particular, I think that Catholicism's strong emphasis on the social nature of human persons challenges individualistic approaches to human rights. And in particular, it challenges ways of saying that freedom to be left alone should override our obligations to care for the poor. So if we have a way of saying, don't tread on me, leave me alone, is a ground for saying, I don't have a duty toward the poor, that's an interpretation of the American tradition that needs to be challenged by Catholicism and should be, I think, lead to some significant developments in our society today. Free markets have a resource that can bring benefits to many, but markets should be regulated when this is needed to ensure that the dignity of poor and marginal members of society are protected, especially when markets have global reach. That's an affirmation of Pope Benedict XVI. Human dignity thus raises ongoing challenges for all traditions of moral reflection, both Catholic and others. And I think my point tonight is to say that we can expect Catholicism to be a continued active participant in this struggle for human rights and a continued participant in the development of deeper ways of understanding the requirements of human dignity. Thank you.
Thank you. I will be the runner here. If you have a question for Father Hollenbach, I will get to you.
Thank you very much for your talk and for all the work you've done over the decades. I want a kind of a comment and for maybe your reflection on that and a kind of question or follow-up on the end of your talk. One, I wonder, you call attention to war in Europe in particular as leading to the change. I wonder if just the spread and intensification of capitalism and capitalist social relations, which emphasize like social role of buyer and seller, lender and borrower, wage labor, which is a voluntary agreement, whether or not those social roles don't really form the basis of the transformation toward a sense of equality and human rights. And thinking, too, just how things have been transformed over the past several decades in many parts of the world with the tremendous influx of women into the wage labor forces. That's the comment. I think in philosophy, I really kind of agree with where you're going at the end of the talk, and I think a Catholic philosophical approach to what you're talking about really would be a challenge because you're trying to put together human rights and the common good. I think the mainstreams in philosophy, I think of people like John Rawls, even Jürgen Habermas in Germany, and just not to mention the more liberal, in the sense of classical liberal views, they all want to distinguish between the right and the good. And they see the emphasizing the good, which of course would be in the common good, as really a danger to the right and human rights. And what any comments on that and what resources in philosophy or Catholic philosophy in particular conceptually to come to grips with that? Thank you.
Well, those are both very important questions. I would say very briefly, on the first point, certainly Roman Catholicism in the late 19th and early 20th century developed very strong views about the, if you will, the rights of working people, right to a just wage, adequate working conditions. And so Catholicism moved into this social and economic sphere in the more modern industrial economy in the 19th and 20th century, well before it came to the point of being ready to affirm the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. My point about war and peace being a stimulus for the affirmation of the full range of human rights was that the church began to realize that it didn't have to stand, that the repression of individual freedom was such a stimulus to war that it needed to open its broader, it needed to approach human rights in a somewhat broader way than it had when it just talked about the rights of working people, the rights to a just wage, the right to adequate working conditions. It began to talk about the right to freedom of speech, political participation, democracy, and then ultimately right to religious freedom at the Second Vatican Council. The second point about the right and the good, and I mean, this is a very, very serious philosophical debate about the relation of the right and the good and all that. I would just want to say that the way in which I understand the Catholic tradition to be formulating this is to say that this is a dichotomy that should not be overdrawn. For example, the U.S. bishops in the pastoral letter on economic justice that Roger referred to, which is now 20 years old, they gave a definition of human rights as the minimum conditions for life in community. So in a sense, rights are understood as the minimum guarantees of participation in community. My right to free speech is not the right just to be left alone. My interest in free speech is not just to be left in my office so I can keep talking to myself. It's a right, my free speech is important so that I can engage in society in a way that can have some influence, so that the right to participate in society and the right to free speech go hand in hand. And if you want to call that a merging of the right and the good, fine. But it's certainly the common good, if you understand the common good as a guarantee of everyone's participation in the life of society, then rights and good go together. So it's a question of how to define this. So it doesn't accept the preconditions of liberalism of either you're left alone or you're suppressed by community. There's a third alternative, and the third alternative is active participation, which is both freedom and part of the common good. Hope that responds to the general direction.
I want to thank you especially for Economic Justice for All, which I've taught many times. Thank you. I remember when it, in the 80s, we had even our president said we have to teach it, you know, and so there was Economic Justice Across the Curriculum requirement, which is why we had so many copies on our shelves. And it really brought up debates that I think the church is in its pastoral sort of formation of the faith life of people, I think it's really left that behind. I think so many, like we're in a business school here, and I wonder in as part of the formation of business majors, whether a really deep critique of libertarian thinking is going on, which is at the heart, you know, what you were just saying, trying to overcome these false dichotomies. I think Paul Ryan kind of epitomized for many people, well, this is a sense that this is exactly what being Catholic means. And then, I'm not sure to understand how it's happening. I really applaud the focus on Africa, but in some sense, I think there's a focus missing on what's happening in the United States in terms of students probably thinking that about unions is something really wrong or evil, and living wages is, you know, against the market. So any comments on that?
Right. Well, I mean, I would say that I regret very much that in the last 15 years or thereabouts, there hasn't been as strong an emphasis on some of these economic justice questions as there was back in the mid-80s with the pastoral letter of the bishops on economic justice for all. And there's some complicated reasons for that, having largely to do with the kind of appointments of bishops that were being made by John Paul II and Benedict XVI. I think we're going to see a very different story coming under Pope Francis. At least that's my expectation, that he's clearly committed very strongly to bringing the agenda of poverty in the world and poverty in the countries that we like our own back into the forefront of church thinking. And that, in my judgment, is a very valuable move. I'd hope to see that happen much more powerfully. The church's tradition on this issue has been there for a long time. I think both, particularly Pope Benedict XVI, came from a European context in which he was most concerned about what he saw as the secularization of European society and began to take an agenda that tried to respond to that. I think that, in my judgment, the best way to counteract secularization, if you will, or unjustified or inappropriate secularization, is to show that the church really has something to contribute to society that can make a difference. And I think that's what Pope Francis is already saying, that what we've got to do is we've got to show that it makes sense to think about being a Christian. And how does it make sense? It really makes a difference into the quality of people's lives and, I think, quality of society that we live in. And that's where I think we ought to be able to see movement in this direction toward reaffirming the fundamental economic justice questions. I mean, the inequality of our world is greater now than it has been for modern memory. The inequality of the United States is gravely sharper and deeper than it was when the U.S. bishops wrote their pastoral letter back in the mid-1980s. The poverty level in this country is higher than it's been for generations. There's something wrong when we live in a world that's as rich and as technologically capable as ours is to have that degree of poverty and that degree of inequality. There's something not working. The people at the top are getting richer and richer, and the number of poor is growing. That's true in Africa. It's true in the United States of America. There's a problem. We've got to address it. And I think that's one of the issues about bringing these issues of human rights as being not only about individual freedom to be left alone to do my own thing, but also to guarantee minimum levels of participation in the economic life of society. That's the agenda, I think, for human rights 50 years after Pachymenteris. At least that's my reading of it. So I didn't put it as strongly in my paper as I just did now, but that was between the lines of what I was saying in the paper.
Would you join me again in thanking Father Hollenbach for his talk?
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the 20th Annual Marco De Porras Social Justice Lecture, sponsored by the Justice and Peace Studies Program in Creighton's College of Arts and Sciences, in honor of Father John Marco, S.J., who started the Omaha De Porras Club in 1947. Their patron, Martin De Porras from Peru, was canonized by the Catholic Church in 1962. The speaker was David Hollenbach, University Chairman in Human Rights and International Justice at Boston College. He spoke on the topic Pachymenteris at 50, Catholics and Human Rights in the 21st Century. Father Hollenbach has made a return appearance in this lecture series, having given the first Marco De Porras Social Justice Lecture at Creighton in 1994. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, November 14, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.